Scripture reading, 2 Kings, chapter 10, verses 28 through 31, from the New American Standard. Thus Jehu eradicated Baal out of Israel. However, as for the sins of Jeroboam, the son of Nebat, which he made Israel sin, from these Jehu did not depart, even the golden calves that were at Bethel and that were at Dan. And the Lord said to Jehu, because you have done well executing what is right in my eyes, and have done to the house of Ahab, according to all that was in my heart, your sons of the fourth generation shall sit on the throne of Israel. But Jehu was not careful to walk in the law of the Lord, the God of Israel, with all his heart. He did not depart from the sins of Jeroboam, which he made Israel sin.
Good morning. It's great to be here this morning. I'm glad to be here. I'm glad to be here because it is the Lord's Day, and this is where we're supposed to be. And as Christians, this is where we should feel most comfortable, most happy, most secure. We are designed and made to worship God, and so it's wonderful to be here and do that. I'm also glad because over the last couple of months, I haven't had the opportunity to assemble like this. As you can imagine, Army-authorized and Army-created services are not really that fulfilling. They just kind of do it, and, so it's good to be here for that reason. I'm also glad to be here because no matter how far I go or how long I go from being here, this feels like home to me, and so it's good to be home, and it's good to be with you and see all your faces, and I am humbled and privileged that I get to bring you a message from God's Word this morning, and I hope that it's fulfilling to you. The lesson this morning should be one of encouragement. It is to me. And the lesson this morning, I'd like to begin by posing a question, as so many good lessons are offered. And the question is, what are you clinging to? What are you clinging to? And I was nervous about the question because both my English professors are here, and I end that question with a preposition. But I looked it up, and I think I'm okay. So I can change it. It's not too late. So I'm getting smiles. So what are you clinging to is the question I'd like to ask us all this morning. We just read a story about Jehu, and we'll get to that in just a minute. We all know that in times of trial, whether big or small, we are given a choice, a crossroads, if you will, and we can choose to ignore God and choose to lean on our own understanding and our own strength, or we can choose to say, God, help me out of this situation. And sometimes trials test that, right? We say, God, you're not helping me the way you're supposed to be helping me, in my opinion. And so then we run away from God and we say, fine, I'll do it on my own. But when we are smart and when we have our hearts in the right place, that's when we cling to God, right? That's when we hold to his hand. And I thank Donald for leading all those songs. That is when we seek God out so vehemently. I remember a story that I was reminded when I was studying this lesson. Edgar Allan Poe's Descent into the Maelstrom. Again, points from the English professors, I think. So in this story, there's these sailors off the coast of Norway, and there's this huge storm breaks out. And it creates a whirlpool, a maelstrom, swirling around miles across in the ocean. And their boat, their wooden ship, which is sinking, is now trapped inside this maelstrom, slowly, slowly rounding around and around like a toilet bowl down into the depths of the ocean, and to certain death. And one of the sailors, he gets this idea, you know, all hope is lost, and for hours, and, you know, Poe goes on and on and on about how miserable he is, because that's what Poe does. But eventually the guy sees this empty cask, and it's floating up out of the maelstrom instead of down. And so he gets this idea, and so he lashes himself to this cask with ropes, and he clings to it with his fingernails, and he gets lifted out of the maelstrom slowly, slowly, and he survives, and he tells the story years later. And that visual is very powerful to me, this guy clinging with everything he has to this cask, the one hope he has to survive, and that's the way we're supposed to be clinging to God. That's the way we're supposed to cling to the truth and to righteousness, because that is our only hope and our only way out of certain death. If we look at 2 Kings chapter 9 and 10, just a brief survey of these verses, we'll see a man named Jehu who became king of Israel. And Jehu is a really interesting character in the Bible to me, which is why I think he illustrates this lesson so well. So most people in the Bible are either good or bad, right? I mean, even the good ones make mistakes, but you know, we know they're good. David was a good king, right? He was a good guy. Josiah was a good guy. Then there's all the bad guys, and you know them. They're the bad guys, right? Caiaphas, bad guy, right? He's the one who mocked and crucified Jesus. And we know who they are. Jehu is one of these guys who just kind of walks the line. And I remember in Bible class as a kid, they had up around the border of the classroom all the kings of Israel. And they're all either smiling or frowning. You know, there's Josiah with his golden locks and his young face, and he's all happy and smiling. So you know he's a good guy. And then there's Ahab, and he's, you know, frowning, gray-haired, ugly, you know, he's clearly a bad guy. And I still remember Jehu had the most neutral face. It's like they couldn't decide if Jehu was good or bad, so they said, we're just going to make him flat-lipped, generally kind of, you know, regular face, regular hair, everything. And that was a pretty accurate picture of Jehu, because as we read, he did a lot of good stuff, but he also did a lot of bad stuff. So if we look at Jehu briefly, in 2 Kings 9, verses 21 through 26, we'll read a little bit about Jehu. So 2 Kings 9, 21 and 26, Joram, one of his opposing evil kings, right? Joram says, make ready. And so they make ready his chariot. And Joram, the king of Israel, and Ahaziah, king of Judah, sets out, each in his chariot, and went to meet Jehu, and met him at the property of Naboth the Jezreelite. Remember Naboth, murdered over his little vineyard by Ahab and Jezebel. And so when Joram sees Jehu, he says, is it peace, Jehu? And Jehu answers, what peace can there be so long as the whorings and the sorceries of your mother Jezebel are so many? And automatically, we love Jehu, right? And so Joram, hearing this, reigns about and flees. And he says to Ahaziah, treachery, O Ahaziah. And Jehu draws his bow with his full strength and shot Joram between the shoulders so that the arrow pierced his heart and he sank in his chariot. But Jehu said to Bidkar his aide, take him and throw him on the plot of ground belonging to Naboth the Jezreelite. For remember, when you and I rode side by side behind Ahab his father, how the Lord made this pronouncement against him. As surely as I saw yesterday the blood of Naboth and the blood of his sons, declares the Lord, I will repay you on this plot of ground. So therefore, take him up and throw him on the plot of ground in accordance with the word of the Lord. And Jehu has done it, right? Sweet vengeance for Naboth. He's killed these evil people. He is starting to clean house in exactly the way God wanted it done. Fulfilling the prophecy of God, avenging Naboth's blood. And as we keep reading in verse 27, he continues this kind of rampage. When Ahaziah, the king of Judah, saw this, he fled in the direction of Beth-Hagon. And Jehu pursued him and said, shoot him also. And they shot him in the chariot at the ascent of Gur, which is by Ibleam. And he fled to Megiddo and died there. His servants carried him in a chariot to Jerusalem and buried him in his tomb with his fathers in the city of David. And so Jehu is, in one fell swoop, has knocked out these two evil kings. And, I mean, you read this, and in the way that, you know, the ups and downs of the righteousness of Israel go, you think, man, they're on the up and up. Jehu is on the right track. And albeit it's pretty violent, but he is putting Israel on the right track. And you're rooting for Jehu at this point. And it continues. In verses 30 through 34, Jezebel is next, right? The queen of evil. I mean, her name is synonymous with evil even today. And Jehu takes her out too. In fact, he is so powerful, he has so much righteousness on his side, he just calls up to the servants, to the eunuchs, and says, who's on my side? And three eunuchs stick their head out the window, and he says, throw her down. And her own servants cast her out of the tower. She falls. She's torn apart by the dogs so that they can't even recognize her to bury her. And it, I mean, this is bloody stuff. This is R-rated Old Testament material here. But it is righteousness, right? I mean, this is what God wants to happen. This is justice on the evil. And Jehu is the arbiter of that justice. And at this point, I mean, Jehu is like your favorite character in the Bible. And he keeps doing good, right? In chapter 10, he continues this rampage of righteousness. He goes to the temple of Baal. He tears down the pillar. He kills all the prophets of Baal. And he turns the house of Baal into a latrine. Just to make a point that this kind of evil is not going to be tolerated by God and by Israel. But then what happens? Well, we just read in our reading So Jehu wipes out Baal from Israel in verse 28 of chapter 10. But we read, Jehu did not turn aside from the sins of Jeroboam the son of Nebat, which he made Israel to sin. The golden calves at Dan and Bethel, those golden calves that were set up so long ago, continue to be a thorn in the side of Israel. And he refuses to tear them down. And we read also in verse 30 there that not all of his heart was dedicated to God, right? He did not fully commit himself to God's plan. He stopped short. He did not cling to God's plan for him. He did not seek out God. He clung to something else. And we can kind of speculate why he didn't finish what he started. So some have said that he didn't want to lose his local places of worship. So Dan and Bethel, you could worship Jehovah there, but you just also could worship idols. You could worship the golden calves. And if you take out these places of worship in Dan and Bethel, where's the only place left to worship? Well, it's down at the temple in Jerusalem. And that is his rival nation. And so his entire power base would be gone in this religious society. And so all of his people would then rely back on Israel or on Judah in the southern kingdom and on Jerusalem. And so maybe Jehu didn't want to lose his power. He didn't want to lose this consolidation that he had fought so hard for, right, in his own mind. And so he stopped short. So he did as much of God's plan as he wanted to do. And then he departed with God. And he did his own thing. And the irony is, if we keep reading, his kingdom falls apart because of this. Verse 32 of chapter 10, in those days the Lord began to cut off parts of Israel. Hazael defeated them throughout the territory of Israel. From the Jordan eastward, all the land of Gilead, the Gadites and the Reubenites and the Manassites, from the Aroer, which is by the valley of the Arnon, that is Gilead and Bashan. They just start picking Israel apart one by one. Now, if Jehu had torn down these idols, this wouldn't have happened. It's clear that God was dismantling this kingdom of Israel because they were not righteous, because Jehu stopped short. He did not cling to God's plan for him. Instead, he clung to his own ideas of what was important. He clung to pride, he clung to power, whatever it was, it certainly wasn't to God. And the kingdom that he supposedly loved so much fell apart because of it. And the Bible, we know, is full of examples of people like this. Lot's wife, remember, she clung to something, some love of the decadent evil in the evil city of Sodom, right? Because she turned around to look back. Why didn't she cling to God's plan for her, which was just to walk forward? That's all you got to do. But she couldn't do that. She had to go look back at her precious city one more time, and she was turned into a pillar of salt because of it. Instantly. The rich young ruler, of course, was clinging to his love of his possessions. He did everything up with God up to that point, until he hit that crossroads and God said, I want you to do something that you don't want to do. And he went away sorrowful. He did not cling to God. He didn't really cling to Jesus' teaching. He clung to his own idea of what he was supposed to be doing. And the nation of Israel as a whole had this obsession, right, of having a king, of being like the nations around them. Jehu, Ahaziah, Joram, all these kings, this was all caused because of Israel's mistake. Decades, hundreds of years ago, right? They wanted a king. They wanted to be like the nations around them. They weren't clinging to God's plan or clinging to God, right? We don't need a king. We have God as our king. That was not their attitude. Their attitude was, we want to do what we want to do. We want to live our life and our kingdom the way we want to live it. And think about all the problems created because of that. Because of the stubbornness, the stiff necks, as Stephen called them, the stiff necks of these Israelites. And of course, we do the same thing. We see it all the time in our modern lives. We may do it personally. We see other people do it. That, you know, they'll do good. They'll be good people. And they'll say they cling to God up until a point, right? Everybody hits that point, or a lot of people hit that point, where they say, yeah, I'm going to do this much, but that's asking a lot. And they're stuck. They're obsessed with some idea that they've had all along. I heard a story not long ago about an officer in the Army. He was a colonel for the Navy types. That's a captain. Just make sure you all got that. He was a colonel, which is a pretty high rank, right? He is one promotion away from being a general officer. and his whole career, that's what he wanted to do. And the promotion list came out, and he wasn't on it. He didn't get promoted to general, didn't get confirmed by Congress or whatever they do. And he did the absurd thing of taking his own life because he couldn't stand the thought of not being a general officer. All the success he had had in life. He had a family, he had children, he had countless subordinates and people who worked for him who probably loved him. But none of that mattered because he was obsessed with this preconceived idea he had that he had to go make this one rank or do this one thing. Absolutely absurd. There's this old country song. It's called I Never Picked Cotton. And it's a story about this guy who, he's a little kid and he grows up on a cotton farm and he sees his mother and his brothers and his sisters out in the fields all day long, bent over till they can't straighten up their backs picking cotton. And he swears to himself as a child, I'm never going to pick cotton. And so he runs away from home. And as soon as he gets old enough, he steals a truck, he steals a gun, and he starts living this life of crime. And all through it, all the chorus is, I never picked cotton. And eventually, his waywardness catches up to him. He ends up in some kind of fight. He kills a guy, and he's sitting in the jail cell, the gallows outside waiting for him for the next day. And he looks back and he says, you know, there's not a lot I can look back on my life with pride, but I never picked cotton. And that's his thing, right? I mean, that's the one thing he cared about. This ridiculous obsession he made as a child is what he was clinging to even moments from death. With that, I'd like to think about our final lesson from this evening, our final passage from Luke 23. From Luke 23. We'll see another example of a man moments from death and devoid of penitence. So in Luke chapter 23, Luke, by the way, I read somewhere that it's the most beautiful book ever written. Some scholars have said that. And I don't know how they measure such things, but I do know when we read stories like this, you can make a pretty good case for it. So Luke 23 and verse 39. Of course, the setting here is the crucifixion. Jesus is already hanging on the cross. He has been mocked by the soldiers, by the crowd, by the Jews. He has been beaten. And now he is moments away from death. And so we pick up our reading in verse 39 of Luke 23. One of the criminals who were hanged railed at him, saying, "Are you not the Christ? Save yourself and us." But the other rebuked him, saying, "Do you not fear God, since you are under the same sentence of condemnation? And we indeed justly, for we are receiving the due reward of our deeds, but this man has done nothing wrong." And he said, "Jesus, remember me when you come into your kingdom." And Jesus said to him, "Truly I say to you, today you will be with me in paradise." And what a remarkable scene we have here. We have a conversation here between crucified men. You have these three men hanging on the cross. Jesus, we're told from other gospels, is in the middle and there is a criminal on either side. And I'd like to look at this first criminal, this man who mocks Jesus. And of course he is being sarcastic as he says, "Save yourself and us," because he thinks Jesus isn't going to save anybody. He's being crucified along next to him. But isn't it incredible that this man, condemned to death, moments from death, tortured, beaten, maybe not to the same extreme as Jesus, but certainly in incredible pain at this moment, right? Certainly having the threat of death hanging over him, he still has this obsession with this mocking of Jesus, that he's going to mock the Lord and Savior, moments from death. It's inexplicable to me. It's incredible that this man would do this at this moment. And maybe he was caught up in it, right? Because all the crowd is mocking him. The soldiers are mocking him. The Jews were mocking him. And maybe he was obsessed with this idea that the Jewish elite had about Jesus. And so, you know, maybe the years preceding this, he had heard about Jesus and he hated him and he just wanted, and now he's next to him and so he gets a chance to mock him. I don't know why. But he was clinging to that obsession, right? That this petty vitriol that he wants to spew at Jesus, both of them moments from death. Even unto death, he clings to the state of mind. And it's incredible to me. What's even more incredible is as we look at this second criminal. Because the second criminal, also under condemnation of death, also in the pain, in the final throes of his life, hanging on a cross crucified, he defends Jesus from this other criminal. Instead of hanging on his own, ignoring this conversation around him, just wishing he was dead, just feeling sorry for himself. He has the wherewithal and the gumption to stick up for Jesus from this other criminal who mocks him. Incredible to me. And this man is the example that I want to look at for our lesson. And there are three things I think we can learn from this man. The first lesson: it's never too late to cling to Jesus. I mean, how many minutes did this guy have left on earth? Not many. And yet, he was snatched from the jaws of Satan in this moment, this final historic moment in time, because he chose to cling to Jesus. Jesus didn't say, did Jesus say, well, I mean, which step are you on in the steps of salvation, right? He wasn't worried about that. Jesus had the power at that moment because this man clung to Jesus and Jesus saved his life, saved his soul, just like that. It is never too late. It is never too late to cling to Jesus and be saved. I mean, the other interesting thing is from the other Gospels, we know these two men were insurrectionists. They were revolutionaries. They were terrorists. The same thing Jesus was really being accused of and the same thing he was condemned for. These men were guilty of that. And so their crimes, they had led generally parallel lives, right? They were both criminals. They were both obsessed with, I don't know, subverting the Roman government or something. And so they both got condemned at this day, at this time, and somehow ended up on crosses right next to Jesus on the day he was crucified. How fate pulled them all together at this one moment. And they represent in some ways the same person, right? Because one chooses to mock Jesus, one chooses to cling to his own passions, and the other one chooses to cling to Jesus, to cling to the cross in the final moments of his life. It's never too late, never too late to cling to Jesus. The second lesson I think we can learn is that clinging to Jesus takes a commitment and it takes some self-sacrifice. It took a cross to get this guy saved. There's that song we sing, "Nearer, my God, to thee, nearer to thee, even though it be a cross that raiseth me, still all my song shall be nearer, my God, to thee." Well, it took a cross to get this guy saved. It was a cross that raised him up to put him next to Jesus, to give him the opportunity to cling to Jesus. And Jesus, what did he say to him? "Today you'll be with me in paradise." And that's the third lesson I'd like to learn from this man. It's worth it to cling to Jesus. It is absolutely worth it. It is not just living this ascetic, painful life that you hope at the end you get some kind of reward, right? It is absolutely worth it. It was worth it for this man in this moment. "Today you'll be with me in paradise." What an incredible statement from Jesus. What an incredible grace he offered this man at this moment. Peter said, "Let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good." Trust your souls to a faithful Creator. Trust your soul to Jesus, because he will not disappoint you. And so I ask the question again, what are you clinging to? What are we all clinging to on a daily basis in those thousand decisions we make every day with every little trial and every little speed bump we hit? What are we clinging to? Do we try and cling to our own passions and our own abilities? Or do we try and cling to Jesus and just lean on him and help him guide us? Let him give us that peace that passes understanding, and let him give us that reward so that one day he can say, "Today you'll be with me in paradise." Cling to Jesus and to the truth as we stand and sing our song this morning.